Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. I am incredibly pleased to have, once again, Mads Turgeson, who is the principal designer of C#. How are you, Mads?
I'm doing great. How are you, Jesse?
I'm really good, really good. We were saying just before I started recording that I realized that I've been programming in C# for 21 years because I got the early bits in 2000. So that's I've been through the progression, man.
That's a while. That's a fair bit longer than me, actually. I got into the whole C# thing in earnest only, in quotes, 16 years ago.
Yeah, well, I was doing C++ before that, and C# was wonderful because no memory leaks. And to show my age, I was doing C before that. So there you go.
Yeah, I only did those in school.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, C# has been a lifesaver for me and has been my whole career. So thanks very much and have a good night.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, so C# 10 is coming. When is C# 10 coming?
It's coming in November. It's part of the now yearly heartbeat of .NET. After a little, there's a new major version of .NET every year now, starting with .NET 5 last year or whenever it was, .NET 6, .NET 7. And we, after a little consideration, we decided to do the same thing with C#. Just follow that heartbeat, have a whole number version of C# with every release. And then, it's not meant to, this is more frequent than we used to, and it's not necessarily meant to speed up the degree of innovation or new features in C# over time any further. It was already, we were doing that at a pretty high clip, but more to sort of give it out in more frequently in smaller portions. So expect the increments to be smaller, but more frequent. That is sort of that's the theory.
So we could have at some point infinitely fast, but infinitesimally small releases.
I guess at the limit, yes. There'll be a new release of C# every hour.
Okay, so C# 10 has a number of new things, some of which I understand, many of which I don't. And as usual, I'm interested not only in what it is, but where I would use it. So it looks like a good place to start would be my favorite property patterns that apparently have been extended.
Have they?
Let me see. This article says.
Oh, I think, yeah, we did the, did we do nested patterns? I think we did, yeah. Property patterns, that actually eludes me right now that we did anything with them in C# 10.
Well, this little article I found says, beginning with C# 10, you can reference nested properties.
Okay, that thing, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I almost forgot about that. It's a little feature, but it's neat. You know how you can nest property patterns in C# already, but you sort of have to do it the slow way of putting another property pattern on a property to get at its nested properties, and now you can just dot your way directly in. I think that's what it's referring to.
Yes, sounds like it. Okay, let me try something else that you might remember.
Man, not so many.
There, it says here that we now have record structs.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. That I can help you with. C# 9, the one of the big things in C# 9 was records, but they were only, records are a special, they're a special version of classes, right? So you can say that your class is a record. You use the record keyword instead of the class keyword. And now all kinds of, default behaviors change. You get value-based equality instead of reference-based by default, and you get a number of other value-based behaviors. We also enable what we call non-destructive mutation. So this is with keyword in C#, that you can go up to a record and say that one with, and then an object initializer to get a copy of the old record, but with certain things changed, right? So it's a way to program with immutable data that records enable. Now, that was awesome for classes, but and a lot of that value-based behavior is something that already naturally exists in structs today. In fact, we model it on structs and make sure that the value-based equality behaved the same way as it already does in struct and so on. But there were still some of the things that records ended up having that structs couldn't do. And so we said, okay, let's enable record structs as well. So now you can say record class or record struct. You don't have to say class if that's sort of the default. default. But if you say record struct, then you get a struct that, of course, still has its value-based equality that it always had, but now it can also, it also has, you know, little things like an equality operator, a good two-string implementation, the ability to have primary constructors, that's a very compact syntax for generating them. So that's sort of like, let's take the extra goodness that records had over structs and then pull that back to structs.
And so once again, when would I look at something and say, wow, what I need is a record struct?
Well, so when you want to use your structs as values, you want to be able to compare them based on what's inside, like you do with a tuple, for instance, today. A tuple is a good example of something that if I were to program it manually, I would do it with a record struct. In fact, we deliberately we had an eye on value tuple as the language supported tuple type as sort of a model for what record struct should behave like. If you write a record struct with a primary constructor, and pretty much the if you write a record struct like that, it behaves the same as a value tuple. So if you're interested in those value-based behaviors, then that's when you would do a record struct. We did sort of go the extra mile and say, hey, that non-destructive mutation really only requires that a value has the ability to copy itself. That's not something that that classes have built in, right? So we had to sort of make that a special thing of records. But all structs can copy themselves. That's what happens whenever you assign a struct. That's just like how they assign. And so we said with expressions actually now works for all structs, regardless of whether they're declared records or not. That's another way that we brought some record goodness back to structs.
Uh-huh. Okay. I could see where that would be highly useful. One of the things that I thought was really cool, it's a small thing, is global using directives, which I can't decide is going to be a great typing save or it's going to be dangerous.
Ah, what's dangerous about it, do you think?
It's a good question. I don't know what I'm thinking, except that you're bringing in libraries or code that you may not need everywhere. Help me think this through.
Yeah, I mean, we did get some of that reaction. When we were thinking it through, people are like, I'd like to see at the top of my file what exactly I'm depending on. You know, there are IDE features in Visual Studio, for instance, that will help clean up your usings and remove the ones that you aren't currently, quote unquote, using. Right. And we felt like there was a whole lot of kind of micromanagement that people felt compelled to do. And that wasn't really necessary. It's very rarely a problem that you have something in scope, you know? And so for the vast majority of cases, people either have the same usings everywhere or they sort of might as well have. You know, mm-hmm. And we're like, well, let's take that out of people's faces. There's optionally, let's let people put that in one place and say, that's where I centrally, put all my usings, just say global using, and then it applies to everything in the project or in that assembly. And if you don't like it, well, you can do it individually. But let's say you want to take a dependence on a new thing. Now you don't have to go through and put it everywhere. You just put it in that one place, and now you have that dependency.
That's a great thing. I like that. And I can stop doing little light bulb and then add this using and on and on.
Yeah. And actually, from a tooling perspective, we sort of went a bit further, or the SDK team did, and are actually now putting some global usings in by default. They're not even in your source files. They're just assuming they're there and using the language feature to put for a given project type. You know, they just put the things in that everybody always has anyway, and that used to be just part of the templates that you would start a project with. Mm-hmm. So we really like taking it out of people's faces and just offering it up. There are ways you can turn it off if you don't like it, but the default behavior, you know, we try sometimes in the past, we've catered a little too much to the complex edge case at the cost of the mainline experience. And that's something that we're trying to get better at. And this is one of the ways that we're trying to improve the experience that you get when you first come, not, you know, when you first come to C#, or when you do fairly normal things, you know, when you select a project type, a template, and say, I want to do an ASP.NET, a website or whatever, you know, why don't we just give you the default things instead of making you sort of have to think about, do I need this? Do I need that? And in the language as well, that's a direction that we're going. You saw it in the previous release of C# with the top level statements. Why make you go through all the ceremony? Why do you have to learn the secret handshake or, you know, copy paste it from somewhere, have a template, put it in that you have in your static void main and all that stuff? Why do you need magic incantations to get anywhere? Let's make it easy by default. And that also, go ahead.
No, you please.
Well, that goes for another feature that we did in C# 10, which is file scoped namespaces.
Yes.
Because if you look at C# files today, everything except the three lines in every file is indented by four spaces or however many spaces you use for indentation. Because namespaces, almost everything is in a namespace. Almost every file has only one namespace. And so everyone starts with namespace blah, open curly, and then everything's indented. And then several miles down, you have the end curly. And we felt like, you know, this is so common. And we actually measured the public code in GitHub to see how common. And it's more than 99% of files. Like, it's super, super common. Like, let's take this indentation away, you know? Let's just allow you to say namespace something semicolon. And then everything in the rest of your file is inside of that namespace. And
oh, that's great.
So now with the usings, we've shrunk your files sort of vertically, and with the file scope namespaces, we've shrunk them horizontally. And with the top level statements of the previous release, we've shrunk some of the boilerplate away, and all that combined means that what a main program looks like and what most of your source files will look like if you sort of program in a quote unquote modern way now using the new features has materially changed for the better. Like, we've removed a lot of just extraneous filler from your source code and focusing in on what actually matters. You know, your code actually matters. So
that sounds good to me. I'm a big believer in making things easier, and using the 99% case certainly makes sense to me to make that the default, and then you can turn that off if you like.
Yeah, I mean, no one forces you to use these new features, but in the 99% case, it's probably a good idea, you know?
Yeah. We have talked before about my refusal to understand why classes are not public by default, and I won't harangue you about that, but an example for me of every time I declare a class, I have to go say it's public, but don't mind me.
I mean, I can see where you're coming from. I honestly can. I just feel like that is, you know, some things we can change by offering an alternative syntax that's better. Mm-hmm. That one I just don't see as being able to change, even if I 100% agreed with you, which I'm not sure I do. But, you know, we can't change the default behavior of something.
Right.
That would break, you know, all the code on the planet pretty much. Right. So, right. So that ship has just sailed.
Yeah, that's okay. I wouldn't leave it to default anyway. I'd still annotate it by putting public in, so it wouldn't really help.
Right. Yeah.
So what else do we have in 10? We've got, actually, I wanted to ask you about, you said in passing top level statements. And
yeah.
I'm not as familiar as I should be. But is that used only in the main part of the program, or?
Yes. Oh. For now, it's a very simple replacement syntax, if you will, for having a main method. It does the same things. It allows, with a very few exceptions, which we're making fewer and fewer, it allows all the same scenarios as the full-fledged, you know, class or struct with a main method inside.
Mm-hmm.
But it just allows you to put statements directly in your file for your main program. So I think it's one of those simplifications that, you know, we try to make them so they both make the language more approachable to someone who comes from elsewhere or who's new to programming altogether. But at the same time, it remains the good way, the simpler good way of structuring your code, even when you're accomplished and for most tasks. Like, unless you have a very expert need. So those are the features I really like. I don't like to have beginner features that run out of steam once you like want to do something quote unquote real. But I like simplifications that make the language more approachable and gets more, makes it clearer and simpler for everyone, even experts, that kind of have the full expressiveness, even as they're syntactically simpler.
Right. And you've been adding that a lot starting at 1, but certainly I've been noticing it starting at around 7 and 8.
That, yeah.
There's more and more of that.
It's always been something that, I think it's always been among the values that we've been chasing with C# design. I think that, but it's become more of a very clear, articulated focus lately, and one that applies in a more coordinated way across the language and the framework, for instance, and ASP.NET in particular has been a very close partner of us in the C# 10 release to enable some of their simplicity scenarios as well. Maybe we'll get to what we've also done with Lambdas there to help them out. For everyone's benefit, but for theirs in particular, for their scenario.
Tell me about that. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, we made several improvements to Lambda expressions that just make life better if you were in a sort of a callback situation. Like you typically are, if you're setting up an endpoint, you want to say what happens on this route and on that route. And that typically involves signing up some callbacks saying, or call this code whenever, one of the things that, I mean, lambdas are, they're pretty nifty from a syntactic point of view, but from a type perspective in C#, they're pretty weak. They always have to be immediately converted to a delegate type or an expression tree type. They always has to be, somebody has to have expressed a type that they are immediately converted to. They can't just have a type on their own. And that's something we wanted to change. We made it so that if a lambda expression has enough type information inside of it, lambdas optionally can have types on their parameters. And typically when they do, we can infer their return type. You can also now actually explicitly give a return type on a lambda. That's part of the improvements as well. But when there's enough type information, we will infer a delegate type so that if you're not converting explicitly to a delegate type, like if you're saying var f equals some lambda, we will infer a type for you, a delegate type for you. It'll either be one of the action or func types if there is an appropriate one in the library that you're targeting. The BCL has up to, I don't know, some 16 or 32 parameters or whatnot, overloads of action and func. But if there's not one that fits, either because it's even longer or because it has refs or whatever, then we'll just generate one for you into your assembly. So if there's enough type information, we will, to even be able to do it, we will give you a good standard type for your lambda. And that means that's a lot of hurdles you can get around.
When you say that a lambda expression has to be translated into delegate,
mm-hmm.
that isn't something that I would see as a day-to-day developer, right? That's something that is being done under the hood, or have I been doing it wrong all this time?
Well, oftentimes you're using a library, and that library, like say you're using link and you're calling the where method or the select method or something.
Yes.
Then it will have a delegate type in its signature, then the library gives you a delegate type, and then your life is pretty easy. You just have to write a lambda that fits, that is convertible to that delegate type. So many times it's just up to the library, but sometimes things aren't as simple. And in particular in ASP.NET, there are often situations where there are multiple different shapes of lambdas that would be, acceptable, and they use reflection or source generators to make sure that the right thing happens depending on the shape of the lambda. And there it's very cumbersome to try to provide all the overloads. So what they can do now instead is they can have one overload that takes delegate, system.delegate, which is the base type of all delegates. And then people can just call that one thing and have the actual delegate type generated for them by the compiler now, that the delegate actually gets created from and then passed to that method. And then reflection can take over from there, or the source generator can look at the Lambda and put some extra overloads in behind the scenes, depending on what's needed. So it's that kind of situation. It's a that enables a more flexible, a more programmatic approach, if you will, on their side to which Lambdas they are able to expect, rather than a forest of predefined overloads that is, miserable to look at because there are so many of them and still probably not adequate for some scenarios.
Got it. Or I think I got it.
Sometimes you just want to create the delegate yourself, and being able to just say var f equals and then get a right type for it. Sometimes you want that, just in your client code as well. It's not always that you're just passing first class functions to a library.
Let me return to property patterns, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
The example that I have in front of me has bewildered me. It says that instead of, try that again in English. It says that I can now do brace prop1.prop2:pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what that's doing.
Well, it's a shorthand. Property patterns, you apply them to a value of a certain type, and now inside of the property pattern, you can, in a recursive manner, apply patterns to the members of that type, the properties and fields, by saying field name colon. That's been the case for a couple of releases. And now if you want to apply a pattern to something that's nested inside of a property of, if you want to look at a property of a property, then previously you had to apply a new property pattern to the outer property so as to get to the inner property to apply a pattern to that. It's hard to explain this in audio, but you sort of had nested curlies.
Mm-hmm.
And now instead you can ask the question more directly. You can just say, prop A dot prop B instead of saying prop A colon open curly prop B colon. So it's just a little shorthand.
How do you do that straight out of your head? That's amazing.
Well, it comes at the expense of so many other things that could be in my head, but that's not really.
That's my problem. My head is filled with jingles from the 1960s, so I can't learn anything new.
I'm sorry, but yeah, I remember so many phone numbers of old classmates and that kind of stuff that is completely useless. But I can't remember the phone numbers of my own kids.
Yeah, there's a lot of that going around. Constant interpolated strings. When would I use that?
It's mostly an optimization feature. It's a little more than that. We want to make sure that there's some simple forms of interpolated strings that the compiler knows what they mean. It doesn't have to call string.format or whatever. It knows what they mean. And in those cases, like in a well-defined set of cases, we say, okay, since it knows what it means, it's just a prettier version of using the plus operator in a sense, on strings, then let's allow that to be computed at compile time and therefore to be a constant. Constants are a special thing in C#, right? There are a certain subset of values that are known at compile time, and therefore they can be constants, and therefore they can be used in patterns, for instance, and in other places where you can only use constants,
mm-hmm.
Attributes. There are a couple of places where you have to use constants. And we just said, well, when it's obvious what the interpolated string is going to do, let's allow the compiler to consider it a constant.
Okay, that sounds cool.
Yeah, it's a simple little feature. I mean, there's a lot, there are lots of those little improvements that are mostly you won't notice. There'll likely be more people who stop going, huh, that's annoying, and then at something that they perceive missing, then there will be people saying, oh, that is cool, right? It's more like removing some suckage than adding some rulage, if you will. Using some old terms of regalipperts there.
All right. I've got one that's really either obscure or I just don't get it yet.
Uh-huh.
Async method builder attribute. On
method. Yeah, that is fairly obscure. Async is a great feature. I'm very proud of it. It stood the test of time. Many other languages have followed in our footsteps and are adopting it. Sometimes, almost to the point of adopting it so literally that they forget to adjust properly for the different situation in their language. But That's all great. But the problem with async is that all else equal, there's a lot of allocation and various other overheads that have kind of been dogging us for when you want to do fine-grained async stuff, you know, where it's really the common cases that the thing is already there, or, you know, other things where you really would like to avoid context switches or allocations or that kind of stuff. And there's been a very fruitful collaboration between the BCL team, and Stephen Tope is very deep into this, and the language team, on sort of gradually allowing more and more ways that more and more kinds of handshakes between the library and the compiler, so that async functionality and async methods can be implemented more efficiently. And this is sort of the latest one of those, where we can, essentially, it has to do with how customizable the async feature is. You know, to what extent and in what places can someone provide their own implementation of the asyncness, that's the async builder, rather than relying on the default behavior there. And nobody wants to do that, except for Steve and his friends, right? And maybe a few other people out there. But by enabling it and letting Steve and his friends party on that, it means that everybody else calling into those APIs, all of a sudden, things are faster. They have fewer allocations. We get better performance up and down for everyone else who's building on top of those core libraries. So it's one of those kinds of language features that even though it's for the very, very few directly, it benefits, you know, hundredfold, thousandfold the number of developers easily, without most of them even knowing or noticing, which is the whole point, right? It's just a transparent improvement.
My favorite kind.
Yeah.
What else about C# 10 should we be talking about?
I think we covered most of the interesting stuff. There are a few things that we were eager to get into C# 10 that didn't quite make it. We have to get used to this 1 year cycle ourselves. And this was the first one of, you know, that was really, squeezed at both ends. But, one thing that we actually, there was a feature that we spent a whole lot of time on that was never meant to make it into C# 10 as a shipping feature, but was meant to ship with C# 10 as a preview feature. So this is the first time that we've taken a big feature and deliberately put it as a preview, a full release before it's supposed to go out. And that means that when you get C# 10, you can turn on preview, and there's actually a new flag to turn on preview for the framework as well. And when you do, we enable a whole bunch of stuff that where the main scenario is to allow generics to work well with numerics. So generic, numeric abstraction, if you will. The language feature is a pretty big one. It is to allow abstract static methods in interfaces. So your interfaces today can have instance members that are either virtual or non-virtual. And they can have static members that are non-virtual. So it's not, you know, your grandmother's interfaces, but what they can't do is to have static virtual members. Nothing in C# can have that. But we decided to allow that for interfaces so that an interface can say, I want everyone who implements me to have this static member. And one kind of static member is a user-defined operator. They're static members. So I could say, everyone who implements this interface must have a plus, and they must have a minus, and they must have a zero static property to get the neutral element for plus, and so on. So you can actually now start having interfaces that specify numeric contracts. And then when you use those interfaces to constrain generics, now you can use those operators and stuff inside of those generic methods. So you can write generic algorithms in, which is, you know, awkward to the point of being nearly impossible today. And then we took and implemented that as a language feature. We also, or the BCL team implemented a whole library of interfaces to represent common numeric abstractions, you know, iAddable and that kind of thing. And, you know, they're very fine-grained interfaces. And then there's an iNumber that kind of brings it all together. And then we also went and implemented those interfaces on all our own numeric types, all the primitive types and whatever numeric types we have in the standard libraries. But everyone else can also implement them. And then we went to system.math and other places and added overloads to all those utility methods in there that have already, you know, 16 overloads or whatever, like, you know, math.average, that kind of thing. And we put an extra overload that is generic and is where the type parameter is constrained by a suitable interface. And now that one overload now becomes applicable to every user-defined type out there in the universe that implements that interface. So we really opened up numerics for abstraction. And that is so exciting, but it's also a big, it's a set of big hammers. And so we want to make sure we get it absolutely right. And that's why we are putting it out in a preview that, you know, comes out with the RTM release to kind of get feedback, to make sure we bake this and get it exactly right, and to have the ecosystem out there that, you know, there are several people in the community jumping at the bit to start doing numeric things more elegantly with C# and .NET, that they can get a head start on that and help us get things right and be ready for it when we actually release it a year from now.
So the plan is that you might have previews, but there's not going to be an actual release of any new feature at all until 1 year. But you will have releases every year. Do I have that straight?
We will have releases every year, and this is targeted for C# 11. So this is a C# 11 feature that's released in preview along with C# 10.
Okay.
And we think that's something that we'll probably do more of. Releasing features in preview. We already do some of that where if you use a lang version preview, during a year, if you kind of get the updates and the compiler, there'll be some features that pop up before prime time, just throughout the year. But I think for big features that are like really changing the fabric or expanding the fabric of computation, like this one is, we will try to do that a full year ahead of time so that it comes out with the RTM and there's a full year of bake time, together with the community.
Sounds like a plan. Sounds like a good plan. You in the past have written some great blog posts for C# 9, C# 8. Are you planning on putting something together for C# 10, or have you already done?
There will be one. We haven't put it out yet. I think I'll sit down with Kathleen Dollard and we'll write it together. We're already throwing some ideas around. So that should come out sometime between now and the release at .NET Conf.
Great. Well, as usual, this was amazing. I'll have to listen to it two or three times to fully grok what you've said. But,
you can always call again.
I appreciate that. No, this was truly great. And I'm actually very excited about C# 10. I didn't mean to say actually. I am very excited about C# 10 because there's a couple, as you said, small but very useful improvements.
Yeah, I think I'm excited about it too. It's nothing is like earth shattering, but I like the way that it has the potential to just change the way code looks for the better. You know, it takes C# a little further into the, you know, it makes it a more modern language, just even to look at and to get to read, you know, and I like that.
Great place to stop. Mm-hmm.